All that's left to do is to introduce our speaker for this morning, Mr. Andy Tilsley.
Just start by saying we are still very much at the beginning of what we're doing in Sutton. Johnny and Hannah, you're welcome to be at the start. 19 minutes to journey from your home. It's great, great, really easy. Great, there we go. Another day, another moment of destiny. There we go. Anyway, it falls to me to open our time together. And before I read the passage for this morning, I want to start by setting some of the next day and a half and some of where we're at as a church in some kind of context. Last summer, summer 2018, I had the privilege of going off on sabbatical. Hugely grateful to the church for releasing me to do that. In fact, the church retreat last year was my first 2 days back after 9 glorious weeks away from all of you. upon my return, as I caught up with you, something rather striking happened. Once we got through the small talk, I started asking, you know, what's really been going on in church life? What's the goss? No, we don't goss here at Christchurch. What are the prayer points? What's really been happening in the life of the church? And all your responses were basically the same. Different people, different services who seemingly hadn't communicated with each other were all relaying to me exactly the same thing. Everybody was expressing this kind of stirring, a kind of longing for what I might call revival. A great move of God that leaves our lives and our church, our city and our nation forever changed. And to be honest, when I look back on that about 12 months ago now, it's not like that has really ever left us. It's not like that was a 2018 thing and, oh, now we've moved on to something new. No, we still long and we still wait. And this has really shaped our leadership over the last 12 months. It shaped some of the things that we've spoken on from the front of church. We've spoken on things like fasting and called the church to fast. We've had regular weeks of prayer at a time. And under this theme of our longing for revival, as David said, the themes of kind of holiness and mission and faith feel particularly significant at this point in our journey. Now, just to be clear, I'm not saying with all of this that this definitely means revival is coming. None of us know that. None of us know that. But what I would say is if this is what different ones of us are feeling stirred about, it kind of gets me excited for what God might be up to. A couple of months ago, I watched some of the BBC series, The Earth from Space. I'm not sure if you've seen this. Absolutely stunning imagery. And during the first episode, I had a little bit of a God moment. The camera zoomed in on a herd of elephants in Africa in the middle of drought season. And this kind of sad music came on in the background as the camera zoomed in on a baby elephant in danger of losing its life, so hot and arid and dry were the conditions. And then suddenly the camera zoomed up to outer space, image a bit like this, and the narrator said words to this effect: the rains are only 6 days away, but they just don't know it. And as I heard that phrase, a question popped into my head. What if revival is just 6 days away and we just don't know it? Would I live any differently if I did? What if life and hope and refreshment is on the way? What if it's coming really soon? How would I live if I knew that? That's kind of what I want to look at this morning. And under this theme of our longing for revival and how on earth do we live in the meantime, in particular this morning, I want to look at the subject of holiness. In fact, I feel I'm to call us as a church to holiness, but not necessarily in the way that I understood holiness growing up, and I'll share more of that in a moment. But I want to start by reading a few verses from 1 Peter chapter 1. If you have a Bible, I would love you to turn there. The words will also be on the screen if you want to follow along. Just 4 verses from 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 13. This is what Peter writes. Therefore, with minds that are alert and fully sober, set your hope on the grace to be brought to you when Jesus Christ is revealed at his coming. As obedient children, do not conform to the evil desires you had when you lived in ignorance, but just as he who called you is holy, so be holy in all you do, for it is written, be holy because I am holy. Okay, what's this all about? What's this call to holiness all about? Well, when I was a kid growing up in church, holiness was always taught to me through the lens of moral purity. Obey God, keep your life clean, be holy. Now, I'm sure most of you know this. The word literally means to be set apart. But that was always framed for me as being set apart from all the bad things that people are doing out there. Don't do the things they do. Don't say the things they say. Don't watch the things they watch. Set yourself apart. Keep separate. Keep your life clean. Be holy. Well, I guess in some ways that has something to do with holiness. But in my opinion, that has as much to do with holiness as being married has to do with not having an affair. I want you to imagine for a moment there's a couple on their wedding day and they've said the vows and he's kissed the bride and they've come out the church and they've gone to the reception, they've had the lovely meal and now it's speeches time and the groom stands up, thanks everyone for coming and then says, just want to let you know everyone, now we're married, I'm not going to have an affair. What do we think? You know, maybe believing the best, we'd want to commend him for his commitment to commitment. That's an underrated virtue in our culture today, sure. But most of us would probably more likely be thinking, what on earth are you doing? She's right there. Why on earth are you focusing on that? You should be focusing on the dazzling beauty in white that's next to you right now. Rather than focusing on what you should be set apart from, the stuff that you shouldn't do anymore, you should much rather be setting your focus on who you're set apart for, the relationship that you're now made for. I think holiness is very much the same. I think holiness is less about being set apart from all the stuff we shouldn't really be doing. And I think it's far more about setting ourselves apart for the one for whom we have been created. Relationship with Jesus Christ, the one for whom our soul aches. And so if I had to sum up this talk in a sentence, it would simply be this. Let's devote ourselves to Jesus again. Before we get to anything else, before we get to what's God saying to me or my service, our dreams for our city and our nation, before we get to intercede and pray for our world, let's just remember who it's all for, why we do all this, what it's all about. Let's focus on the dazzling beauty in white. Let's devote ourselves to Jesus again. And to be honest, I think this is Peter's point in writing, not just these verses, but actually both of his letters. He kind of says this explicitly, 2 Peter 3:1, it's coming up on the screen. He says this, dear friends, this is now my second letter to you. I've written both of them as reminders to stimulate you to wholesome thinking. Elsewhere in 2 Peter, he puts it like this, I will always remind you of these things, even though you know them, I think it's right to refresh your memory. I just want to be clear, I want you to know that I know that you know that Jesus is amazing. I know that you know that there's no one and nothing better than him. But I just feel it's right to refresh our memories. I feel like as I'm praying about where do we start this retreat, this is where we have to start. I know you know this, but let's remember again, there's no one like him. He's amazing. Let's just focus on the dazzling beauty in white. And to be honest, this is Peter's key to holiness. Just remember how amazing Jesus is. He says, therefore, be holy. Because I've just written, be holy. What's Peter just written in 1 Peter 1? Well, I've put it in bullet point form for you. It's coming up on the screen. He talks about the great mercy of God. Our new birth, this amazing new relationship. The fact that Jesus is alive, verse 3. Our inheritance that can never perish, spoil, or fade. God's power shielding us. Our faith that's of greater worth than gold. Of Jesus being revealed to us. Though we haven't seen him, oh, how we love him. As we believe in him, as we know him more, we get filled with inexpressible and glorious joy. He writes about the goal of our faith, our soul salvation, and the glories that will follow. Verse 12, that this salvation, this relationship so amazing that even angels long to look into it. Therefore, because of all of this, with minds that are alert and fully sober, set your hope on the grace to be brought you when Jesus is revealed. Be holy. Remember again how amazing Jesus is. This is Peter's key to holiness. And I think one of the reasons this is his key to holiness is because he knows what happens to us if we don't remember how amazing Jesus is, if we don't fix our hope and our minds on him. He actually says this explicitly in the verses that we read. He said this, before you knew how amazing Jesus is, before you'd experienced this amazing salvation, what was our condition? It says we lived in ignorance. We did not know how amazing Jesus is. What happened when we lived in ignorance? Peter says we conformed. In fact, the way he writes it makes me think that maybe conformity and setting our hope, setting our minds on Jesus, almost like opposite sides of the same coin. If I'm setting my hope, it's because I'm not conforming. If I'm conforming, it's because I'm not setting my hope. I think Paul would agree. Do not be conformed to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. So before we get to how and why we set our hope on Jesus, I just want to spend a few minutes of what happens when we don't do that. What exactly is conformity all about? Well, I'm really glad you asked. Many of us, I'm sure, have heard of a guy called David Foster Wallace. We quote him often here at Christchurch. He wasn't a follower of Jesus. Amazing author and communicator, though. Very tragically committed suicide, age 46, in 2008. And in 1996, he wrote a best-selling book called Infinite Jest. Hands up if you've actually read this book. No one. What a group of culture vultures we are. Philistines. Well, I can say whatever I want now. Basically, the question he kind of asks rhetorically through this book is this. If there was a movie that's utterly amazing, utterly compelling, everyone is watching it, but we knew that watching this movie would ruin our lives, would we still watch the movie? In the book, he writes about a fictional movie called Infinite Jest. And this movie is utterly addictive. It's totally captivating. It stimulates eyes and hearts in a way that nothing else can. When people watch the movie, at the end of it, all they want to do is rewind it and watch it again and again and again and again, so much so that nothing else can hold their attention at all, and their lives just collapse into meaninglessness, and they are left, and I love this quote, possessed with roughly the mental or spiritual energies of a moth. Now, here's the question he asks. If we knew a movie was that good, but that's what it did to us, would we still watch it? Here's his answer. In many ways, we already are. In many ways, we already are. And he basically makes the book a kind of comic parable about our relationship with modern-day entertainment. That it's utterly compelling, but actually, that's part of its problem. And because of this, maybe we're being conformed into less than God intends for us. Christian author and journalist Tony Reinke says of this book, he says, the problem is not that TV, and you can replace TV with the internet, social media. It's not that it's innately evil, but that it is endlessly good at giving us exactly what we want whenever we want it. David Foster Wallace peered into profound spiritual tensions in the media age. Feeding on sinful media will annul our holy affections, yes. But pampering ourselves with a glut of morally neutral media also pillages our affectional zeal. Each of us must learn to preserve higher pleasures by revolting against lesser indulgences. Whoa, that is a quote. What he's basically saying is this. The problem is not that TV and the media is just endlessly evil and bad. It's not. Yes, there is bad stuff that we shouldn't fill our minds with that can like dilute, if not annul, our passion for God, sure. But maybe its problem is it's just endlessly good at feeding us with exactly what we feel we want. But maybe in doing that, we are settling for lesser indulgences. We're settling for less than the best, rather than preserving ourselves for higher pleasures. I love that phrase. Are we settling for lesser indulgences, rather than preserving ourselves for the best? You see, the problem is the kind of media that surrounds us every single day. It's shaping us. It's conforming us way more than we might care to realize or admit. I came across some absolutely fascinating research on this. This actually came out in 2015. It's been replicated a number of times since. They took a large group of people and they primed some of them just to think about money. Just got them thinking about money, bank accounts, consumerism, finance, and the like. In fact, I've actually got some video footage of this experiment. It's silent. If you want to play the video now, I'll just start talking over it. So groups, some are primed with money, some just thinking about a neutral subject like paper. And when they leave, they all pass somebody who accidentally drops a whole load of papers and folders on the floor. Now, this first person has not been thinking about money. They very kindly stop to help. Everyone else you see in this clip has been thinking about money, and they pass the person in need again and again and again and again and again. I mean, it's just extraordinary. In fact, they've done a number of similar experiments, and they have found that just thinking about money, all we have to do is think about money, it makes people more selfish and more self-reliant, more likely to lie, and more likely to behave in ethically dubious ways. And they've not just done experiments like this focusing on money. They did one experiment where they got people to think about old people. They got them thinking about words like Zimmer frames and retirement homes and wrinkle creams. And then all they did, rather than walking past a person in need, they just timed how slowly or how quickly they walked away from the experiment. Those who'd been thinking about old people walked significantly slower than those who had not. I mean, just a remarkable set of experiments. You can read about that in Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink. Now, here's the point of the illustration. I just want you to imagine for a moment, just imagine, you live in a culture that bombards you with messages, images, and ideas of wealth and sex and fame and power and the quest for personal pride and glory. Just imagine you live in a culture like that. Do you think there is at least a teeny tiny chance that we as a result are being conformed into less than God intends for us, less than the best? The sobering truth is right now, I am the fruit of what I have filled my mind with. This time next year, I will be living and enjoying the fruit. I'll be reaping the fruit of what I filled my mind with. Peter basically says this, before you knew how amazing Jesus is, you filled your mind with lesser stuff, and as a result, you conformed. You don't need to do that anymore. Why? Now you know how amazing he is. And so Peter asks me a question. Am I conforming, or am I setting my hope? One or the other is happening to every person in this room. If I look at the summer, 2019, the last 5 years of my life, have I been setting my hope, or have I been conforming? And what about you? Peter says, you don't need to do that anymore. You don't need to settle for lesser indulgences. Why? We get the dazzling beauty in white. Now we know how amazing he is. So be holy. Set yourself apart for him. And this is why we need to be holy. Here's the simple reason. It's because he is holy. Be holy because he is holy. There is no one like him. He is altogether other. He is altogether set apart. He is higher and better and purer than anyone or anything else. You know, twice in the whole of Scripture, we're given a little insight into what the angels are singing around the throne of God. Isaiah chapter 6, Revelation chapter 4, separated by over four centuries. And on each occasion, the angels are singing exactly the same thing. Holy, holy, holy. There's no one higher and better and purer than you. Let me try and put it like this. I did this illustration years ago, but I like it. I'm going to draw a little shape on there. Like a bit of paper here. It's not very good, but Lars, if I just pick on you, can you just tell me what that shape is? It's on the screen as well. It's a square. Congratulations, it's a square. Everyone can see it is a square. Okay, one more shape from me. Here we go. Lars, for 20 Danish points, what is that? It's a box or it's a cube. Well, you have fallen into my little trap, my friend. You see, it's like a box, it's like a cube, but it's not actually a box because it lacks the third dimension of depth. Now, I just want you to imagine for a moment, I had to communicate what a cube or what a box is to you, but I only had the two dimensions of a piece of paper. Well, I could draw it from different angles, I could come up with different illustrations and analogies, but at the end of the day, every description would fall short because I just lack that extra dimension. It's exactly the same with the holiness of God. Every description I could try and give you about how amazing and awesome and incredible he is, it would just ultimately fall short. Why? He's a dimension beyond our understanding, but oh, it should lead to worship. You know, often in the scriptures, you see the writers kind of grappling for these kind of descriptive words. I think of Paul, Acts 26, when he describes his encounter with Christ on the Damascus Road. He was like, oh, he's like the sun. But no, he was brighter than the sun. I mean, what must that have been like? What radiance and glory. Psalm 39, the love and the goodness of God. Oh, it's like the mountains, but no, it's higher than the mountains. Oh, goodness, that's high. What on earth is this like? Sometimes God is likened to a lion and a lamb and an eagle, and yet somehow he's stronger and gentler and more regal and more majestic. Like, this is our God. This is the life into which we are called. This is why we should be holy, because there's no one better than him. Are we settling for lesser? Or are we setting our hope on the best? You know, every December, I love watching my kids' interaction with the presents under the tree. If you know my family, we love Christmas. We basically buy our tree in July. We decorate it in August. We're ready to go now. I mean, we just love Christmas. And Joy's equally a big Christmas fan, but when we got married, we merged together two very different Christmas traditions. In my family, you don't open any presents until after lunch on Christmas Day. You wake up in the morning, you go to church, you put God first in my family. You come back, watch a Christmas movie, have lunch, stand up for the Queen, and then you all open presents one by one, and you ooh and ah over every person's joy and excitement. And, you know, basically you make the joy last as long as possible throughout the day, you know, as Jesus intended. Like, that's my family's Christmas. Joy's Christmas, very different. When I first saw this, I mean, I was just shocked. Basically, you wake up on Christmas morning and you charge downstairs and you tear off the wrapping paper without reference to anyone or anything else. When I first saw this, I was like, whoa, that is feral. I mean, it's like a pack of wildebeests over an injured, a pack of dogs over an injured wildebeest. I mean, it's just wild. So, of course, every Christmas, when my kids open presents, depends on whose family they are with. So when they're with my family, I mean, it's just, like, hilarious. They come down Christmas morning, and they're all in one pyjamas, and like, oh, the presents are there, and wow, whoa, oh, but they can't open anything till after lunch. I mean, it's basically how it works in my family. So what they do, they've developed this kind of habit. They know they can't open anything, so they go to the tree, and they find all the presents with their name on. And they just create a little pile of their own presents. And they just sit with them for like as long as they can. Just like in awe. Just like, I'm just here, Daddy, I'm okay. And they squeeze and they mooch. And what's the point of the illustration? There is a point to the illustration. don't judge me. But here's the point of the illustration. My family's way of doing Christmas is basically a glorious illustration of the gospel. That's basically what's going on. See, Christmas morning in my family, my kids have no idea. They can't fully compute all the excitement and delight that await them under that sparkly wrapping paper. They don't fully know the excitement that awaits them later on in the day, but they know enough. And because they know enough, they know it's good to get as close as possible and to sit in wonder and awe and expectation for the moment when they will be fully and finally united with what's inside. That's exactly what Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 1. We don't fully know how glorious and amazing and wonderful and pure and radiant and majestic he is. I can't put it into words. He's holy. He's altogether set apart, but we know enough. And because we know enough, it is good for us to get as close as we possibly can and to sit in worship and awe and expectation, longing and hoping and waiting for the moment when Jesus is fully and finally revealed to us. We don't need to settle for lesser indulgences anymore. We don't know it all, but oh, we know enough. So let's be holy for him. Let's set ourselves apart for him. So I just want to finish by getting really practical. How do we do this? How do we set our hope on God? How do we set ourselves apart? Well, as I mentioned last summer, I had 9 weeks off on sabbatical. And I very carefully planned out every day, like reading, writing, study, prayer, rest, holiday. You know, I wanted to be as responsible as possible. And I didn't really know what to expect. I've seen other people go away on sabbatical, and often they come back a bit like Moses descending the mountain with the 2 tablets of stone. It's like, I've read this book, I've heard this podcast, I received this prophetic word, I've seen this model of church, life is never the same again, listen to me. I was like, oh, what's going to happen to me? And after 9 weeks, God gave me no tablets of stone. Instead, he spoke to me in a really unexpected and rather surprising way. About 4 days before I went off on sabbatical, I just felt God say this: if you really want to find me, if you really want to meet me, you will find me in the ordinary and the everyday. You will find me in household chores and walks up supermarket aisles and train journeys and your relationship with Joy and the family. You'll find me in the ordinary and the everyday. I mean, Joy was like, the Lord has spoken. We must obey. Like, just felt God say, put away your books and your plans and just meet me there. And you know what? I really did. You know, often when I hear people talking about setting your hope on God, oh, it makes me feel so tired. It makes me feel like I've got to go to my room and close the door and concentrate for 5 hours. And, oh, I found him finally. Or I've got to pray 24/7 and finally I get breakthrough. Now, what I discovered afresh was just the simple truth that every waking moment is an opportunity to connect with the otherness of God. If there was a quote that kind of defined last year for me, it was from a little-known Victorian poet called Elizabeth Barrett Browning. She was very infirm and sick from about 15 years old, had a very difficult life. And she said this: earth is crammed with heaven, and every bush aflame with God, but only those who see take off their shoes. Earth is crammed with heaven, and every bush aflame with God, but only those who see take off their shoes. In other words, wherever you go, it is crammed, it is brimmed with opportunities to connect with the otherness of God, the holiness of God, but only for those who see. In other words, it's really easy to miss him. I want to thoroughly commend our longing for revival. So excited. Think it's wonderful, and I want you to know I feel it too. I'm utterly desperate for God to move. Utterly desperate. Doesn't our nation need it right now? I mean, don't we need a move of God? But we really need to remember this. Revival is no guarantee of a vibrant spiritual life. Revival is no guarantee of a deep connection with God in here. This is what Rabbi Jonathan Sacks says. He says, miracles, revival does not induce faith. Within just 3 days of the Red Sea parting, people are grumbling about not having water. Faith is seeing the miraculous in the everyday, not waiting every day for the miraculous. You know, the key act of deliverance and salvation in the Old Testament, wall of water, right, left, amazing miracle. Their enemies vanquished behind them. And just 3 days later, it's like, oh, where's God? Not enough water. He's left us again. Faith is not waiting for some great move of God to come. No, he's here now. Earth is crammed with heaven. Every moment's an opportunity to connect with him. Martin Luther, the great reformer, I tried to find a picture of him smiling. There's not a single one. I mean, like, I really looked hard for you. I'm sure he was cheerier than that. He once preached an entire sermon, like an hour and a half, the entire content of which was about the spiritually transcendent activity of changing dirty nappies. That was his sermon. Like, even when your hands are in poo, you can connect with God. Earth is crammed with heaven. Like, oh, Jesus came as a baby. Utterly vulnerable. Like, he did this. What was that like? Such weakness and vulnerability. How does that speak to my vulnerability now? Oh, he's here. He's here. Earth crammed with heaven. Some of you, I'm sure, have heard of a guy called Frank Laubach. He was a remarkable guy. He was known as the apostle to the illiterates. Through his ministry and mission, helped over 60 million people read. A big social reformer, campaigner for justice. But this amazing guy got to a point in his life where he just felt dissatisfied with what he described as the shallowness of his relationship with God. He's like, oh, there's got to be more. I want to go deeper. What do I do? And so he wrote a little devotional. It's just 15 pages long, called The Game with Minutes. The way it works is this. He says, set yourself aside an hour. He said, maybe do it in church. Church may be the best place to start. And see how many minutes of that hour you can bring Jesus to mind. Maybe the first time you play this game, you do it 12 times. He's like, that's your score to beat next time you play this game. He talks about this game being so simple, how you can play it with your children. Your children can learn to just bring Jesus to mind every moment of the day. There's a section about how you can do this on a busy train carriage. He says, just start whispering Jesus, Jesus, Jesus under your breath and see if anyone on the train stands out and just start praying for them. He talks about, there's a whole section entitled Merchants and Bankers. He says, if you work with spreadsheets and numbers, you just need to know Jesus cares about those spreadsheets and numbers way more than you do. So just invite God in. When he'd walk along the pavement, he'd deliberately walk to one side and imagine Jesus was walking next to him. And every stranger that passed him is like, have you got something for them, Lord? Do you want to speak to them? Led to some extraordinary conversations. He led countless people to faith, saw amazing societal transformational breakthrough. But he said it also helped him in the ordinary moments of the day. He described moments when he'd lose something, like a set of keys. He's like, I just want to invite God in. And I'd suddenly know exactly where they were. He said it was like tapping into a constant stream of life and joy. I actually found a free PDF download of this book for you. If you want to download it, there's the link. If you want to take a photo of the screen, it's just 15 pages long. You can read it before bed tonight. You can read it in the break after this session. But I just want to warn you, you'll learn nothing new. I'm reminding you of things that you already know. Earth crammed with heaven. Every moment is an opportunity to be like Moses at the bush, our shoes off, holy ground, God's here. I love the story of Joanna Flanders Thomas. She was born and raised in apartheid South Africa. And just felt God speak to her about going into a place called Polsmoor Prison, which was basically the darkest place in the country. It was a prison largely ruled by rapists and murderers. So much so that if you were a new inmate, to qualify as an inmate, your initiation ceremony was to violently assault another prisoner. Violent deaths were really common. And this little lady feels Jesus speak to her, this is your mission field. So in she goes on her own into the bowels of this prison with this simple message, Jesus is here. Earth is crammed with heaven. The year before she went in, there were 279 acts of serious violence, almost one a day. The year after she started going in, there were just two. The reason, she said this, Jesus was there all along. I just had to make him visible. Even amongst murderers and rapists, the darkest corners of our planet, Earth, is crammed with heaven. God's just everywhere. And every waking moment is a chance to connect with the otherness of God. But only for those who see. Only those who see take off their shoes. Just one final reflection on being holy, on setting ourselves apart for the dazzling beauty in white, on setting our hope on him. This is both really easy and really hard. It's really easy. As I've tried to practice this over the last 12 months, I really have found you can connect with God anywhere, in anything. Like one fruit, I've literally at times found my tastes changing. There have been moments when I've been watching TV and just something morally neutral. And I've just remembered this. I'm like, just bring Jesus into this moment. And it's been like, what am I watching? Why am I doing this? Why am I settling for this? Lesser indulgences, there's more. But it's also really hard. And here's the reason it's hard. Peter writes about this. He says, 1 Peter 2, those desires you used to conform to before you knew how amazing Jesus is, those desires are waging war against our soul. This is a battle. But this is the battle I want to call you to. This is the battle I want to call us to as a church. Let's not settle for less than all he has for us. Maybe I could finish by putting it like this. Revival is not the answer to the longings in my heart, devotion to Jesus is. To go back to that picture I gave at the start of this talk, maybe the rains are 6 days away. Maybe revival's coming. Maybe they're not. Either way, in the meantime, we get Jesus. Can I just invite us to stand? Maybe I can invite the band forward. Can I just ask you for a moment just to close your eyes and just consciously, actively invite God into this moment? If he's in Polesmoor prison, oh, he's here right now. Come, Holy Spirit. Come.